I thought tonight I'd talk about or around the subject of conformity and non-conformity, because I think it is an area rich in paradox, and I think it is quite pertinent to us as meditators. Now, I'm sure that even in using the words us as meditators, there's somebody sitting here going, oh, he doesn't mean me, does he? I'm not part of this group, I'm just watching. So conformity and non-conformity. Have you noticed on TV adverts how the advertisers cover both bases? They show us these images of things that we can acquire that will set us apart, that will reinforce our, give a good sense of our individuality, and we'll have the latest car and nobody else will have the same car, and we'll just feel fantastic because obviously it will make us really happy. And then you think, well, no, they're simultaneously broadcasting this to millions and millions of people. So actually what they're after is conformity by selling it to us as non-conformity. Equally, in the fashion world, the same thing happens, isn't it? You get the latest hipster pants, and... I'm down with the kids, undoubtedly. And you walk out in your new hipster pants, and then you see lots of other people all wearing the same hipster pants, and you think, oh, thank goodness, it's not just me, because I'd really stand out if it was just me, but everyone's wearing them, so that's cool, I'm in. So, paradox, conformity and non-conformity. We want the individuality, but we want to fit in. Isn't that youth culture all over? The fear of being ostracised. And yet, there's a huge pull, that teenage rebellion, anti-establishment, got to forge your own way. It's part of being kicked out of the nest, isn't it? You've got to forge your own identity. And yet, at the same time, you just want to fit in completely with your peers, and you feel really, really awkward if, for some reason, you end up being the runt of that particular litter. It can be very, very awkward. I know I've experienced it myself, and I'm sure some of you have too. Not nice. There are so many different examples of the paradox of conformity and non-conformity. About the example of two musicians, one of whom is entirely self-taught, can't read music or anything like that, but has practiced a lot and therefore has a really good feel, intuitive touch for a particular instrument. And then there's the person who has had a formal training, and perhaps they swap notes, and the person who's self-taught is sort of, I enjoy it, but not having that knowledge, not having that ability to communicate, because I haven't got that knowledge, is a real drawback. And the person with the formal education in music is saying, yeah, but what I lack is that inspired, quirky, unexpected turn that you take, because I feel shackled by the very rules that I've come to understand so very well. So there's this whole idea, again, of conformity and non-conformity. Of course, society's expectations, career, family, wealth, there is a strong pressure for people, in order that they feel that they fit in, to comply with the expectations of wider society. But then you think, well, what is society? What is society made up of? And it's made up of individuals. So it's just a collective reflection of the wishes of individuals. That's what makes up society. So it's very much couched in individuals wanting to become, wanting to fulfill something, wanting to perhaps try to solidify their sense of self into something substantial that has got a firm identity so that they know where they are, they know who they are, and they know where they're going. So perhaps for a sense of security or for a sense of protection. And that really is what underlies so much of this conundrum with regards to conformity and non-conformity. Because at the same time that everybody wants to fit in, at the same time they want to express themselves, they want to have that sense of individuality, they want to have that sense of freedom to do what they want when they like. And so it seems like we can never really quite reach a point of conclusion that everyone's caught in this trap of conformity and non-conformity. With more recent events, I don't think anyone who has access to media can be unaffected by what's happening in the Middle East. seems that in some sections of society there is a deep need to enforce their beliefs and their will onto other people. And it is deeply, deeply rooted. If you think about it, why does somebody pick up a religious belief? Because of a sense of uncertainty, a sense that I'm lost. That's often what people talk about, isn't it? They feel lost and they pick up a belief in order to feel secure. Now, of course, what you have to do is establish that same belief, because you can't actually prove it to be true. That's the whole problem, isn't it? You can't actually prove it to be true. So by enforcing it, you get other people to reflect it back to you. So you get that sense of security that the people around you all believe the same thing. So it gives you a sense that you are right. And we've seen in the world recently how far wrong that can go, where people can believe that they are acting on behalf of their God, and it is his will that the people that disagree, the non-conformists, are beheaded and murdered, and all kinds of horrible, grisly things happen to them. So we find that the desire for conformity is so very, very strong. Because historically that sort of thing has happened, there was a movement away from religion towards secular knowledge, and science became very much to the fore. Scientific knowledge would give us answers to questions without having to have blind faith. And what appears to happen is that now scientific knowledge has become the norm, and everyone is expected to conform with scientific discovery and beliefs. But then there's a question, and it brings us on to what we're all doing here, is that are there other forms of knowledge apart from scientific knowledge? Are there other ways of discovering things about life other than through science? And if there wasn't, we wouldn't be sitting here, because science would come up with all the answers. And of course, from a Buddhist point of view, there are other forms of knowledge. There are other ways of investigating life, which means that you don't have to go via the high priest of physics. You can find things out directly for yourself, which is radical and non-conformist in the extreme. And thus, it brings us on to the Buddha's teaching. But to sum that up, if you think of it in terms of people, on the one hand, trying to fit in, or on the other hand, trying to be individualistic and going in for forms of aggrandizement, trying to make their self more than, and think of it in terms of this never-ending pursuit of wholeness for the self. Freedom from a sense of division, or freedom from a sense of alienation. Wanting to fit in so you don't feel alienated anymore. Or wanting to aspire and become something great so that you are fulfilled and the world recognises you as being fulfilled. And it's important to think of it in those terms, because this is a major element of our conditioning when we come to the Buddha's teaching. Everyone is trying to secure, protect, or make themselves whole in some shape or form. Buddha's teaching, Buddha Dhamma, Buddha himself said of his teaching that it goes against the stream. Goes against the stream of worldly views and worldly aspirations. In that sense, it is very non-conformist. But at the same time, it conforms to the truth. It conforms to the truth of the way things are. Very paradoxical. He said it goes against the stream. He found out that suffering is caused by, not solved by, craving. The worldly way, as we know, is to seek that happiness, that wholeness, through craving for life to be different than it is. And the Buddha maintained, no, it's the other way around. It's suffering which is the cause of the problem. Craving can't solve the problem. He also maintained, and this is very much all bound up together with craving, he said that, well, he didn't say, but essentially that this whole attempt to fit in, or this attempt to stand out in order to be at peace with yourself, fitting in or standing out, is based on an illusion. The illusion that we are separate in the first place. So only if you think that you're separate, that you feel that you are alienated, and therefore have to do something in order to be fulfilled, to feel whole, to feel protected or safe, or whatever it might be. So he's pointing out that craving that causes suffering and the view of self and this idea of being separate from the world are all bound up together, which goes against the worldly way. Now, how do we find that out for ourselves? How do we discover this for ourselves? In order to find out for ourselves, he gave us a training, what we call the Noble Eightfold Path. And the idea is that one conforms to the training. One recognizes that in order to find out things for oneself, to gain insight into the true nature of reality, you have to have a calm mind, which means you're going to have to master the mind, which means you're going to have to learn all about it, which means that in order to do that, you're going to have to live your life in such a way that it gives you the maximum opportunity. So he devised a training that anyone can enter into of their own volition. It's not enforced. Somebody chooses to enter into it because they see the value and the worth in it. So what does that mean in practice? It means having to conform. And this is where this idea of the conditioning comes in. Because if we're conditioned to try and fit in, or try and stand out, if we're conditioned to try to conform or to be non-conformist in any areas of life, that is going to affect the way we apply ourselves to the training. It's going to have a deep impact. And it does need to be understood. If we take it from the point of view of somebody coming along here, as you all know, because when you come and see me to begin with, I go through what the training parameters are as we establish them here, and everyone's familiar with attending as many group meetings as you can, daily meditation, being willing to accept instruction and implement that instruction and report back, keeping precepts, doing a year's I want you all to do years of retreats. I'm sure you have busy lives and that's asking a bit much. What I mean is 1 week retreat every year. That's as a minimum. Although in certain aspects a person will be fine with doing that, there will be, for everyone, there will be an obstacle. There will be something that they'll trip up against, something that will show them their unwillingness to conform to the training parameters. As for instance, which one shall I go for? Some people find being part of a group very, very easy. There are some people who are drawn to the Sangha, the community of meditators, quite naturally, and they enjoy being in the group. But perhaps for another person, that might be quite challenging because they're non-conformist. Buddha Dhamma does go against the stream. You will have people in your lives, I'm sure, who don't get it, who don't understand why anyone would sit with their eyes closed when they could be out having fun. It does go against the worldly aspirations. You might have people close to you who might actually want you to conform to their idea of what life's all about, and there might be a pressure there. I was never a joiner of groups. I always found that really quite difficult. I only did it in the end and really went for it by becoming a monk because of the need, the desire to overcome suffering and recognising there really wasn't another way. So for some people, that might be a potential obstacle, and it's their willingness and ability to go against their habitual conditioning and to go the other way. And if it is that, oh, I'm not a joiner, join. Fit in that way. Instruction. Accepting instruction. For instance, some people have never meditated when they come along to the group, and that's fine, of course, because they're given instruction and they've always got access to the teacher in order to discuss and hone their practice. Other people already come to meditation here having done lots of meditation elsewhere, and sometimes there can be an obstacle in that they want to meditate as they've always meditated. They wish to conform to the norm in that sense, and perhaps don't quite appreciate that Buddhist insight meditation is different from what they've been doing. I remember talking to one chap who was trying to convince me that there was no need for people to follow one particular meditation instruction if they came along here. And his evidence to back him up, which was really shaky evidence, he said he'd been on a retreat here, and at the end of the retreat, over the last meal, a woman had confided in him that she spent the entire week reciting the name of the Divine Mother. And he used that as evidence to say that you should just be allowed to do whatever you wanted to do. So he was really struggling with conforming to the meditative instruction. But it is really important if you want to know, if you want to give a decent trial to this way and find out whether or not applying yourself to the observation of things arising and passing away does indeed lessen your suffering, then you have to apply yourself to that. If it is that you really want to recite the name of the Divine Mother, then I'm sure there is a group who do that. There seems to be a group for everything in Britain these days, so I'm sure there's a group that somebody could find if that's what they wanted to do. What about keeping precepts? Five precepts, just to remind you, are refrain from killing or harming living creatures, to refrain from taking that which is not given, to refrain from sexual misconduct, to refrain from all forms of wrong speech, and to refrain from intoxicating drink and mind-altering drugs. Now, they are all limitations on one's behaviour, and if someone is applying themselves to the meditation, the precepts aren't an optional extra, they're integral, because they do reveal, through conforming and keeping the precepts, they do reveal where our cravings are, where it is that we're trying to fit in, or where we're trying to stand out. As a for instance of that, think about something like gossip or tale-bearing. It's so easy to do because there is the pressure in the work environment, say, there is the pressure to fit in. And if gossip is an established habit in a particular workplace, it's so easy just to fall into that. And what is the fear of not going along with that? It's being ostracized. It's being seen, being perceived to being aloof or somehow not part of the group. So there can be quite a pressure there to conform. And yet you've also got another pressure, which is conform to the parameters of the training, which include keeping the precepts. So it does reveal so much and is therefore so useful to someone practicing meditation and mindfulness. Another example, retreats. Coming on retreat, there are rules and regulations on the retreat which people are expected to conform with. It's not arbitrary. It's not done just to be dictators. It's actually done for the benefit of the student through not being able to access your normal creature comforts, entering into a meditative environment, making sure that you get to each meditation on time, so there's a schedule, all of which is asking you to conform, to conform, to conform, which is lessening, forcing people to put aside their self-concern, to put aside their own desires about how they want to do things. And through that, lessening of self-concern, although it feels pinched at first, and although it feels like you're being put in this little box, what happens is your mindfulness suddenly comes together in a way that you could never have foreseen. You come out of that sense of constriction and you start to have this wonderful sense of spaciousness and a lovely sense of so much time. Oh, all I have to do is just follow the schedule. All I have to do is just keep on watching what I'm doing, keeping on being mindful, observing things rising and passing away. So that through the being willing to conform to the strictures of the retreat, you suddenly find there is this wonderful freedom, mental freedom, psychological freedom, where you can do real meditative work. Moving on to meditation per se, When we sit down to meditate, the instruction is to rest content in the moment, watching things rise and pass away. And the idea is that we conform to that. Now, given that we're not reciting the Divine Mother's name, and we are actually attempting to do that, we still find that there are obstacles, things that stop us achieving that. We call them the hindrances. Sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, worry and doubt. All of those five hindrances are forms of self-concern. They're forms of wanting to manipulate and control. It might be reorganizing a memory of something in your head so that it turns out as you really wanted it to turn out. Or it might be dabbling about something in the future that's still outstanding and wanting to get the narrative all set so you know exactly what's going to happen. But it's still all about trying to get life to conform to your wishes. That's what the hindrance, that's the driving force of the hindrances. For anyone to successfully meditate, they have to be willing to stop conforming to that habit. If your habit is worry, if your habit is daydream, if your habit is sleepiness, you have to be willing to stop conforming to that habit. And that is very difficult because this conditioning is in deep. It's where it all gets very paradoxical again. There has to be the willingness to stop conforming to the hindrances and conform to the instruction. And you have to develop the capacity and the strong intent to be able to learn how, when you recognize the impulse to go off into a daydream, to go off into a worry, to recognize it, to be mindful of it, and to bring the mind back, because your prime concern is conforming with the instruction, which is to rest content in the moment, watching things arise and pass away. So, got this lovely paradox of ceasing to conform with your habits and conforming with the instruction. It does feel uncomfortable doing that. It's not like you can just suddenly switch it on and deal with your habits and rest content in the moment, watching things rise and pass away. One of the things that arises is a question about your identity. Because if I'm not doing what I normally do, who am I? If you become so familiar with, say, daydream as a mental occupation to fill up the space, then to take that away leaves you with this enormous empty canvas. And it's difficult to find yourself in that emptiness. And so there is a very strong urge to want to go back to the narrative, to go back to the storyline again and again and again. And it takes all aspects of the path, actually, to learn how to do that, to learn to be comfortable with just resting in the moment. Because when you rest in the moment, you realise what a big place life is. It's huge. And it's very empty. But that's okay. Because if you can, and everyone does if they're willing to give it their best, you discover that actually being in the moment, in this the vastness of the moment, there's a tremendous freedom of mind when you let go of the hindrances. What essentially you're doing is letting go of your self-concern, and you're just resting in the moment. And it's there that you begin to see how it is that life is arising and passing away, moment by moment. And this is where the Buddha's teaching and the training gets very, very interesting. Because it's at this point that you really start practicing Vipassana meditation, insight meditation in depth. And again, we're confronted with conformity and non-conformity. Before we enter into insight meditation, we see life, we perceive life as being permanent, as being satisfactory, and as being self. And that causes all the problems. It's through believing there is this separation, that I am separate from the world around me, and that there are real, permanent, and satisfying objects that I can own and control and that will make my life good, which is what creates the craving and what creates the dissatisfaction and what creates the suffering. What we're being asked to do through Vipassana meditation is look closely at what life is actually like. To no longer conform with the perception of permanence, to no longer conform with the perception of satisfactoriness, to no longer conform with the perception of self, but instead observe our experience and see for ourselves, and that's the critical thing, to see for oneself directly in one's own subjective experience that actually those perceptions are false, they are illusions, they are hallucinations. We replace the perception of permanence with the perception of impermanence, not by force but just through observation. You observe that no sound, no touch, no sight, no thought, no feeling, no perception, no act of will, no moment of consciousness lasts. It has no duration at all. It arises and ceases. And it arises and ceases due to conditions, entirely impersonal conditions. The idea is that we discover for ourselves that actually life is entirely catered for without the need for any separate self that owns or controls or manipulates. So what we discover through Vipassana meditation are the three, what we call the three universal characteristics of impermanence, of unsatisfactoriness, because you cannot grasp, own and control anything that actually occurs, and therefore it is deeply unsatisfactory to rely upon anything within the world. And you also see the mark of non-self. And it's through that process that you gradually remove the inclination towards craving for life to be different. You can only crave for life to be different in some way, shape or form if you believe there is a real object, person or situation in reality that can be manipulated, either yourself or somebody else. For seeing the three marks again and again, you know that even though the mind creates these narratives about yesterday and today and tomorrow, you know through your own experience, you have the wisdom to know that all the components that actually give rise to those situations, every component part has a nature to arise and pass away. There is nothing solid or concrete in any of it. You can't worry about something that doesn't exist. You can't fear for something that doesn't exist. You can't get depressed over something that doesn't actually exist. All the bag of ills, the psychological ills that we go through, are there because we do not see life as it really is. We're caught up in an illusion. Or it's illusory. And so the process of meditation means that we go from conforming with perceptions that are actually illusory to conforming with perceptions that are actually true. So you go from one to the other. I mean, when I say the Buddha's teaching is non-conformist, you get what I mean. So all craving and all suffering can only arise because the mind grasps after false information. And once through your own direct experience, you no longer conform with the hallucinations of perceptions, and you see rightly the way life actually comes together moment by moment, that erodes the tendency towards craving. It also erodes the tendency towards self-concern. Self-concern and craving are so interlinked. And that means that gradually you lose your concern about whether you conform or whether you don't conform. You tend to lose any conceit or pride. You become unconcerned about whether you're getting the acclaim that you think that you deserve, because you no longer care whether you deserve it or not. you fit in spontaneously, because you start to comprehend that actually you are not separate from all of this, that there is just this wonderful flow of conscious experience. It has the appearance of separation, but as meditators we look further than the appearance, we look deeper into the underlying reality, and that is entirely transformative. But it is extraordinarily non-conformist, revolutionary. The combination of this whole process and this whole training is the realization of what we call enlightenment, which is the total instantaneous comprehension that there never has been any separation anywhere, at any time. It is the most wonderful realization. It takes us, interestingly, paradoxically, beyond both conformity and non-conformity. Whereas when we're observing how everything is transient and ungraspable and impersonal, we are conforming our minds with the truth. That's a process that we go through. With enlightenment, there is no question of conforming with the truth. Think about it. If you're conforming with the truth, that gives the opportunity for there to be non-conforming. And enlightenment is beyond all opposites. Any opposite implies a degree of separation. Conformity and non-conformity are two sides of the same thing. And when you realize that, you let go entirely of any thought of conforming or not conforming. Somebody who is enlightened is not conforming with anything anymore. Having said that, they may very well live their life by what people consider to be convention, or they will conform with social norms. But actually, they're entirely beyond the world. They've understood something that takes them beyond authority. They no longer require the authority of the priest. They no longer require the authority of the new high priests of science. They're completely beyond all of that. It may very well be that they live their lives according to social norms, but they never for one moment fall into the trap of believing any of that.